So if you would, let's turn over to that. There's a couple of housekeeping items I need to take care of while we're turning to that. Yesterday I mentioned that the symbolism involved in the bringing of something out of the kingdom of men into the ecclesia of God. We need to keep that in mind. Keep that in mind that that not only refers to the lust of the flesh, the lust of life, the lust of the eyes, and pride of life, but it also refers to any false doctrines. As a brother pointed out to me, that could also and does apply to that also. Also, several times within the last few days, I had mentioned John Carter as the book that was the author of the book Times and Seasons is actually W.H. Carter. So if you go looking for a book written by John Carter called Times and Seasons, you won't find it. It's written by W.H. Carter. Okay, let's go over to chapter 12. And as we get into the symbolism involved today on these conquests, I think I need to repeat what Brother Ted said yesterday, that what I say today might not all be right, and everybody might not agree with it. But I think the symbolism that we've already discussed gives credence to what we would like to bring out today. Chapter 12 of Joshua summarizes all the kings and the peoples that were conquered by Joshua and the Israelites. Verses 1 through 6 tell us of the conquests that were made on the east side of the Jordan of two kings, Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. And then verses 7 through 24 tells us of the remainder of the kings that were conquered on the west of the Jordan. If you look, go down to verse 24, and it says that all the kings, 30 and 1, this is actually 31 kings that were conquered on the west side of Jordan. This means that there were a total of 33 conquered by the children of Israel, the 31 on the west and the 2 on the east. The number 33 is 3 multiplied by 11. The number 3 denotes divine completeness and perfection, and the number 11 denotes disorder and disorganization. Therefore, the number 33, the total kings conquered, types the complete divine disorder brought on the Gentile nations when Christ returns. As we stated earlier, Joshua conducted 3 campaigns to conquer the land. Joshua 10 describes the central and the southern campaigns, while chapter 11 gives us the northern battles. I'd like to go to Joshua 10, 1 through 14, and just go through and read this. Joshua 10, verse 1. Now it came to pass when... King of Jerusalem had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, that they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. Wherefore the king of Jerusalem sent unto Hoam, king of Hebron, and to Piram, king of Jarmuth, to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Deber, king of Eglon, saying, Come up unto me and help me, that we might smite Gibeon, for it hath made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. Therefore the 5 kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their host, and encamped before Gibeon, and made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua to the camp to Gilgal, saying, Slack not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said unto Joshua, Fear them not, for I have delivered them into thine hand. There shall not a man of them stand before thee. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and went up from Gilgal all night, and the Lord discomforted them before Israel, and slew them of a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goeth up to Beth Horon, and smote them to Azekah and to Makkedah. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and were in the going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them unto Azekah, and they died. They were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. And there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. It's my opinion that this 10th chapter of Joshua gives us types of the latter-day conquest over the invading armies of Israel in that day. The first part of this chapter tells us of a coalition of kings led by the king of Jerusalem attacking a people now associated with Joshua and the children of Israel. It's interesting that this is the first mention of the name Jerusalem in that form, and it is in the context of war. It's also interesting to me that the king of Jerusalem and his coalition of armies was the first group of people that initiated aggression against Joshua and his host after they had entered into the land. If the work of Joshua types the work of the greater Joshua, then I think that we should find other scriptures that would help to identify this latter-day coalition of kings. The first thing that we should point out is that the king of Jerusalem must have possession of the city. We should keep this in mind as we delve into the antitype of what we read in this chapter. To me, this is a very simple, elementary point, but it's one that's very important. The king of Jerusalem must have possession of the city. In verse 11, it tells us that Yahweh intervened. Verse 11 tells us that Yahweh intervened on the behalf of the nation of Israel and cast down great hailstones on the king of Jerusalem and the coalition of kings that he led. This great hailstone storm, the scripture tells us, destroyed more Canaanites than did the swords of Israel. I believe that there is a great hailstorm also mentioned for the destruction of a latter-day coalition, also led by a mighty king. Let's go to Job, chapter 38. Job 38, verse 22. Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war? Isaiah 30, verse 30. And the Lord shall cause His glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lighting down of His arm, with the indignation of His anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and of hailstones. I believe this is a latter-day prophecy in this part of Isaiah. Of course, Ezekiel 38, verse 22. And I will plead against him with pestilence. This is against the Gogan invader. I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood. And I will rain upon him and upon his bands, and upon the many people that are with him, and overflowing rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations. They shall know that I am the Lord. In the Apocalypse, chapter 16, verse 21, And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceedingly great. It's my opinion that I believe that there will be a literal destructive storm such as we've read. These verses tell us that the defeat of the enemies of God by a great hailstorm is not an uncommon occurrence in the plan of Yahweh. These verses also tell us, I believe, that the verses of Joshua 10 probably type that latter-day destruction of the coalition described in Ezekiel 38, in which we've read. For I think this is the only other latter-day coalition that's destroyed by hailstones. Therefore, if the type and the antitype are true, then the Gogian host must be the first aggressors against Christ when he returns to Israel to set up God's kingdom. Verses 12 through 14 of this chapter tell us of one of the greatest miracles in the Bible. The day the sun stood still would probably be a day that the children of Israel would remember for a very, very long time. But why was this event necessary at that particular time? And does it have any latter-day significance? What did this event accomplish during the time of Joshua? Verse 13 gives us the answer to that question. And the sun stood still and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. The day was lengthened so that the enemy of Israel and the enemies of God could be totally destroyed. This particular event preshadows the future day of Yahweh, when again the antitypical sun and moon will shine together in the heavens. This antitypical sun and moon will represent the divine government and religious systems of the last millennial day of Yahweh, before He becomes all in all. The political and religious entities will be administered through Christ and His saints. Let us read what Isaiah has to say about this. Isaiah, going back to chapter 30. Isaiah 30, verse 26. Moreover, the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days, and the day that the Lord bindeth up the breach of His people and healeth the stroke of their wound. If this event in Isaiah is speaking of the literal increased intensity of the sun, creation itself would be destroyed. I think this is a prophecy of that time when there will be a complete and perfect shining forth of divine authority and glory in the political and religious heavens of the day. Matthew 13:43 declares that the righteous shall shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. And Chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 11. Gives a similar language of that future time. In that day, thou shalt not be ashamed for all thy doings wherein thou hast transgressed against me. For then will I take away out of the midst of thee them that rejoice in thy pride, and thou shalt not be no more haughty because of my holy mountain. I'm reading from Zephaniah. Can't even talk. I can't even find my scriptures. Okay, I'm at the right place. Chapter 3, verse 11. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, and the shining of thy glittering spear. This day was important in the day of, in the history of Israel. But it does type a greater day. Isaiah 36, 38. Isaiah 38, verse 6. Speaks of another literal day like the one described in Joshua 10. Isaiah 38, verse 6. And I will deliver thee and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city. And this shall be a sign unto thee from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he hath spoken. Behold, I will bring again the shadow of the degrees, which is gone down in the sun, in the sundial of Ahaz, 10 degrees backward. So the sun returned 10 degrees, by which degrees it was gone down. And again, this day was lengthened so that the enemies of Israel could be defeated. There will be another antitypical day when this same miracle will be witnessed, although on a far greater scale. Joshua, let's go back to Joshua 10. In verse 14 gives us a very important scriptural principle. And there was no day like that before it or after it that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. The Lord, or Yahweh, fought for Israel. 2 Peter, the third chapter, the Scriptures records that God is not slack concerning His promises. And we know that throughout the Scriptures, God has promised that He would protect His nation and bring them back into the land because of the promises made unto the fathers. This principle will continue to be followed right up until the time when the nation of Israel will finally be granted their complete inheritance into the promised land. Isaiah 28. Isaiah 28, verse 21. For the Lord shall rise up as in Mount Perazim. He shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon. Now this is the same that we're talking about in Joshua 10, the valley of Gibeon. That he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. What strange act and strange work will Yahweh accomplish at that time? Psalms 110 gives us that answer. The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit thou at my right hand until I make thy enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. This is the strange act that, as Isaiah speaks of, that Christ will return to rule the nations of the world in righteous and divine reign. Zechariah 14. The third chapter. I'm sorry, the third verse. Zechariah 14, verse 3, I believe gives us a latter-day fulfillment of the principle of Yahweh fighting for Israel. I'll just read verses 1 through 3. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. Although some may disagree about the time period of these verses in Zechariah 14, we must ask ourselves this question. What is the day of battle in Zechariah 14:3? Notice what verse 14 of Joshua 10 says. And there was no day like that before it or after it that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of the man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Could this be the day spoken of in 14:3, where it says that he fought as he fought in the day of battle? There probably is not a more significant time period or important battle in the history of Israel than when the children of Israel first came into the land and the kingdom of God was initially established. This seems to me to exactly type that day when the latter day Joshua will again deliver the Israelites from their enemies in the land and bring them into complete inheritance. Verses 16 through 27 of Joshua 14 describes the final and the complete defeat of the coalition of kings led by the king of Jerusalem. Verse 16, we read that the kings hid themselves in a cave because of the fear and the destruction brought on them by Joshua. The prophet Isaiah also declares in the second chapter that mankind will again try to hide from the destructive acts of God's judgments in the latter days. Let's go to that second chapter of Isaiah. Isaiah 2, verse 12. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. And upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains, and upon all the high hills that are lifted up, upon every high tower and upon every fenced wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish and upon all pleasant pictures, and the loftiness of men shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be made low. And the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day, and the idols he shall utterly abolish. And they shall go into the holes of the rocks. Remember what we read about the coalition of the kings led by the king of Jerusalem, that they went and hid in the caves. And it also says, into the caves of the earth, for fear of the Lord, for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. And that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made, each one for himself to worship to the moles and to the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and to the tops of the ragged rocks, for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. Also Micah, the seventh chapter, if I can find it. Micah 7, verse 16. The nations shall be confounded at all thy might. They shall lay their hand upon their mouth, their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like a serpent. They shall move out of their holes like worms of the earth. They shall be afraid of the Lord our God and shall fear because of thee. This will be the reaction of the nations initially when Christ returns to carry out the destructions upon them. In verse 24 of Joshua 10, tells us of the ceremonial act of victory over the enemies of God and Israel. It says, and it came to pass when they brought out those kings unto Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said unto the captains of the men of war which went with them, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near and put their feet upon the necks of them. Notice what Joshua says next. Fear not, be not dismayed, be strong and of a good courage. For thus shall the Lord do to all your enemies against whom you fight. Joshua never fails to bring this message of exhortation to the children of Israel. A message of exhortation that we too should always remember. This symbolic act of placing their feet upon the necks of these kings types two other victories over strong enemies. The first victorious act was typically fulfilled Genesis 3:15, by pointing forward to that time when Christ bruised the head of the seed of the serpent. But it also types the latter-day victory of Christ and the saints over the kings of the earth. Let's go to Psalms 18. Verses 32 through 48, but we only want to read verse 40. It says, Thou hast given me the necks of mine enemies, that I might destroy them that hate me. Also, Psalms 149 speaks of the victory of Christ and His saints over the nations of the world. Psalms 149, verse 5. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor have all the saints. We know that when Christ returns, there will be great war upon the earth, with Christ and His saints leading that charge against the nations and bringing them into subjection to the ruler of the whole earth. In verse 40 of Joshua 10 summarizes the success of Joshua in the southern campaign. Joshua was obedient to Yahweh's commandment of Deuteronomy 20, 16 and 17, which said to totally destroy the peoples of the land. Deuteronomy 9, 1 through 5 gives us the reasons for this total destruction because of their immorality and their sinful conditions that we read about earlier. Joshua 10, verse 42, again tells us that Yahweh Elohim of Israel, or He who will be mighty ones of Israel, fought for His beloved nations, as He again will fight in a time not yet future. This brings us into chapter 11, which describes the next confrontation against Joshua and the children of Israel. It tells us of the defeat of another powerful enemy led by one kingdom or king over another coalition. This chapter, in my mind, seems to type the latter-day defeat of the remainder of the nations that we believe will be led by the Pope and his apostate followers, in which the system in which Brother Don's been talking about all week. The second alliance of nations that came against Joshua, if you look at verse 1, was led by Jabin, who was the king of Hazor. The name Jabin means wise. And if you look at verse 10, it says that Hazor was the head of all of these kingdoms. We won't read these verses since Brother Don's covered them very well already this week. But if we go to 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4, Isaiah chapter 14, it speaks of this system that I believe is typed by this king of Hazor in chapter 11. It describes this future head of a second alliance that will come against a greater Joshua. Revelation 17, verse 18, gives us the connection between this latter-day power and the king of Hazor. Revelation 17, 18, And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth, or who was the head of the kingdoms of the earth, just as chapter 11, verse 10 of Joshua says. This latter-day conflict will occur after Christ has reestablished the Israelitish hold on the city of Jerusalem, and after the verses of Revelation 14, 6 and 7 are fulfilled, which speaks of the proclamation of the everlasting gospel in the heavens of the day. Psalms 2 tells us of the reaction of the nations to this proclamation of the everlasting gospel. In verses 1 through 5 of Joshua 11, we read that a general summons was issued by the king of Hazor. This type of situation is also described in Revelation 17, 12 through 14, where again it speaks of a coalition of nations come together to be led by this head. Revelation 17, 12 through 14. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. A coalition, if you will, again. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Micah 5:15 states that in the latter days, Yahweh will execute vengeance in anger and fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard. It will be a great day of war at that time. The conquest of Joshua concludes in the 11th chapter. As we stated earlier, chapter 12 summarizes these conquests, while the remainder of the book describes the division of the inheritance and the last exhortations of Joshua. I'd like to kind of summarize what I see as the conquest of Joshua and the children of Israel and the various types that we might see therein. Everybody see that okay? Is it too blurry or? The first thing that we should read about as recorded in Joshua 12 is the conquest of the two kings on the east of the Jordan. There was the conquest of Sihon, king of the Amorites. And we won't turn and read these scriptures, but you might want to jot them down and look them up on your own. And there was also the conquest of Og, king of Bashan. As we study and read about these two conquests on the east of the Jordan, it's interesting to me that there is no specific mention of Joshua involved in these two conquests. They were also conquered prior to Joshua leading Israel into the land. Now, what does this mean? Could it be a type of the expansion of Israel's borders prior to the deliverance of Israel from the king of Jerusalem? These two lands occupied by Sihon and Og, I believe, now make up what we call part of Jordan and Syria. Could this be part of the spoil mentioned in Ezekiel 38? Next we have is the conquest of Jericho in chapter 6 of Joshua. As we stated earlier, this particular conquest types the defeat and the destruction of all nations that will oppose Christ, but it also types the eradication of all individual sins so that the entire earth will be devoted and consecrated to God and He will be all in all. Next, the scriptures in Joshua in chapter 10 tells us of the defeat of the king of Jerusalem and the coalition of kings that he led. I believe this types the latter day possessor of the city of Jerusalem. We also have God's destructive powers displayed in that particular situation by a severe hailstorm. And we went over these verses that bring this out. This particular coalition was also the first of the group of nations that initiated aggressive action towards Joshua and the children of Israel. In this particular situation, we also read about the day that the sun stood still, which types the seventh millennial day when God's political and religious systems
will be faithfully administered by Christ and the saints. And finally, we have the defeat of the alliance of nations led by Jabin, king of Hazor, or the wise one who was head of all the kingdoms. And I believe this types the alliance of the nations that will be led by the man of sin who exalts himself above all. And these verses that we read are referred to, I believe, describes the nations that will join the Pope after a general summons has been issued to all of his followers. The book of Joshua closes in chapters 23 and 24 with two excellent exhortations that he gave unto the children of Israel. We won't have time to go over all of this, but it is a very worthwhile reading and exhortation to the children of Israel today. The principal message of these two chapters is to remind the Israelites of all the help and the provisions that Yahweh had given them, and that His future care would be dependent on their continual, unswerving obedience to Him. Joshua exhorts the nation of Israel again to remain strong and courageous, and tries to impress upon them the need of wholehearted, single-purpose service to Yahweh in integrity and truth. He also exhorts the people to remain separate from the nations around them, not to enter into marriage alliances with those outside of the covenant, and not to follow the false gods or idols of the Gentiles. He tells the nations to cleave unto Yahweh. If we go to Genesis 2:24, we find that the word cleave is actually a marriage term. In chapters 23:12-13, Joshua tells them the outcome if the children of Israel cleave unto the nations around them instead of God. This word cleave implies an intimate marriage relationship. It implies a separateness, if you will, for the children of God to remain separate from the people of the world. Many individuals of the nation of Israel, throughout the pages of the Scriptures, we read have turned against God because of unholy marriages and also because of the love for the things of the world. In verse 2-13 of chapter 24, contains a reminder of the wondrous works performed by Yahweh for the benefit of His nation. We can ask ourselves, how can this stiff-necked people continue to serve the false idols of Egypt? Brothers and sisters, this is a very difficult question to answer, because I believe the same situation applies to spiritual Israel today. We too have been blessed with many wonderful opportunities to see the hand of God at work. Let's just contemplate and recall just two of these marvelous blessings that we enjoy. The generation of the spiritual nation of Israel today has had the opportunity and the extreme wonderful blessing to see the reestablishment of the natural nation of Israel. It's probably the most dramatic and unlikely event of the last 100 years, at least. This is the event that many believers think will usher in the day of redemption, the day of judgment for the saints and the nations of the world. Not only have we witnessed the miracle of the rebirth of the nation of Israel, but we also are to recall to words the message in Ephesians 2:11-15 and 19-22. We won't read those, but we know those speak of first of the condition that we were in before we came into covenant relationship, and also our extremely blessed position now to be able to call Yahweh, the God of Israel, our God. God has performed miraculous works for each and every one of us. We have been given the wonderful opportunity to come out of the world of darkness, the world of Egypt, if you will, a world racing towards destruction from God's almighty hands, and we're now able to draw nigh to the Creator of the world. What more blessings could we want to make ourselves follow the commandments of Yahweh? We also, this week, have witnessed that God's plan and purpose is still working, still calling out the Gentiles, a people for His namesake. What a wonderful blessing it is when we can see God's hand still at work. But are we living the divine, godly life that's required of us? Joshua 24 reminded the children of Israel of the wonderful blessings provided unto them. Let us not take the blessings we have for granted, but let us follow the examples in the book of Joshua each and every day of our life. The faith of Rahab, the faith of Joshua. Let us not be like Achan and bring the things from the kingdom of men into the ecclesia of God. In verse 15, we've only got a few minutes left. Verse 15 of chapter 24. This was one of the key verses of this whole book. If it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. This is our example that Joshua leaves for us. We can witness, as the children of Israel did, the sincerity, the truth, the integrity in which Joshua lived his life and was obedient to God. Let us try to put aside the gods of the world we live in. And let us, as he said, choose you this day whom you will serve. But as far as him and his house, we will serve the Lord. I thank you for your attention, and I also would like to thank the brothers and sisters of the New Mexico Bible School, first for inviting me, and also for the tremendous amount of work that it takes to put on a Bible school like this.
You made a study of